Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. My car is broken. I'm stressed out about that.
I'm sorry, dude. That's never fun.
A 2010 Volkswagen Beetle, and it likes to turn off when it stops now. So I like to restart it at every intersection.
That's never a good sign.
But I'm not here to dump my problems on you, dear listeners.
I have not come here to praise Whitney's car, but to... No, that's not right. How's that Shakespeare go?
I come to bury Caesar, not to praise
it. I come to bury Whitney's car, not to praise it.
I have a Volkswagen Beetle, and I've named him Werner.
Nice.
Werner von Bug. I'm not sure if you're the kind of person who names your car.
My first car was named Carmine.
Oh, isn't that cute?
I thought so. Anyway,
do you name your car? Write us in.
I'd be curious. Anyway, this is We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation. You email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we also have a P.O. box for those who prefer physical letters. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter. P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Anyway, we read your letters. We answer your questions. We respond to your critiques. We're here for you, so let's not dilly-dally any further. Whitney, what is our first email?
Here's a letter from Todd.
Hi,
Hello,
Todd.
Todd. Welcome to hell, Mr. and Mrs. Knabel.
It's a hell of an intro.
That is a reference to a 1992 film called Stay Tuned.
Oh, yeah! Sorry, that took me a second. Nicely done. I knew that was a reference to something. I couldn't put together.
And I haven't seen all of that movie, but I know the characters' names.
It's been years.
Have you ever watched an awkward cult classic movie like The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai and wondered what it would have been like if it had been headed by an experienced or even premier director like, say, Joe Dante? Or if maybe Robot Jocks had been directed by someone like James Cameron and had a bit of a bigger budget on that one, too?
That would be Pacific Rim.
Yeah, well, I was about to say. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, I have a fondness for movies like that. I was just wondering, watching Firewalker the other night, although that one was by an experienced director with actual acclaim. But I can't help but wonder what would have been if they had gotten a little more care. What about you two? Are there cult classics that you think could have been improved by a bigger budget or a better director? What do you think the results would have been for the films you're thinking of? Have a good evening, Todd.
So we're talking about cult classics here, and one of the ideas of a cult classic is that it's a movie that doesn't have a gigantic audience. Mm. It's a movie that has a small but passionate audience that really loves it for what it is, regardless of whether or not it's entirely successful.
I think Bruce Campbell said a hit film is 10 people, or it's a million people seeing a movie 10 times. And a cult classic is 10 people seeing a movie a million times.
Exactly. There is definitely... cult movies are... They come from anywhere. They come from small, independent filmmakers who just had a dream and managed to get it out there. They come from big studios that fail to sell a movie appropriately or perhaps make it up to spec. But it hit people really, really hard. For me... The idea of what happens when we take a cult movie and we give it a big budget and a big director, we're kind of seeing a lot of that now. Like, there's a lot of, like, big movies that, frankly, it feels like this should be a $1 million production from the 1980s. I think the first movie I can remember thinking to myself, I can't believe this is a Hollywood movie. This feels like a cult movie. If it was a cult movie, it would be beloved.
Uh-huh.
But because... It was a big Hollywood movie. People went, oh, yeah. And then they sort of moved on with their lives. And that's actually Snakes on a Plane.
Oh, there you go.
That
should have been made for like half a million dollars.
Exactly. It's a movie starring Samuel L. Jackson. He's escorting a witness from, I think, Hawaii to the mainland. Mm. And along the way, in order to kill the witness, the gangster has released... like hundreds of poisonous snakes and like sprayed pheromones on them so that they go completely wild on the plane. And now Samuel L. Jackson has to kill all these snakes on the plane. When that movie came out, there was immediate interest from a cult-like audience.
Well, and the title definitely helped. And that's the way they used to sell these cult movies, was they'd have a really lurid title, a really awesome, poster art.
Yeah.
And no script or movie yet. Yeah. They just sort of sell this idea to a lot of local cinemas, and a lot of like Z-grade producers could throw something together really fast and sell it and give it to the theater already sold.
This may or may not be good, but by God, you will see snakes on a plane. That's the idea. The problem is that the movie was a major studio production, and it had a major studio budget and a major studio release. And so when it came out, these small group of people who were excited to see a movie called Snakes on a Plane, they saw it. But they weren't enough to make it a gigantic hit. So the movie ultimately kind of underperformed, and nowadays I don't even think it's generally considered a cult classic. So what I'm concerned with
is I appreciate about Snakes on a Plane in particular is when that sort of momentum began to build.
Yeah.
They decided to make it more like an exploitation movie. They went back and shot a few scenes.
Yeah.
Some fan heard that Samuel L. Jackson was in a film called Snakes on a Plane and improvised the motherfucker line.
Yeah, the line, I've had it with these motherfucking snakes in this motherfucking plane.
That wasn't in the original cut of the movie. Nope. They went back and shot it because that was such a good idea.
And
to
you
the
can
filmmakers.
Tell the lighting is a little different on Samuel L. Jackson in that shot.
And they decided to add a little bit more violence. You notice that the sex scene has nothing to do with the rest of the movie because they shot that one separately. That's all B-movie stuff.
Yeah.
That's all, like, legit, we're just going to cobble something together and make it more lurid as we go, as ideas come to us kind of stuff. That it got a major studio release in mainstream theaters was the bizarre part.
Indeed, and I feel as though that ultimately kind of hurt the movie. I feel like there's a lot of movies that are being made now that are being made by filmmakers with cult-like sensibility, but they're so expensive that even though it's still kind of a cult movie, there's no way it's ever going to make its money back. I feel like something like Real Steel, even though we're finally getting another one of those, because when Real Steel came out...
It's a TV series, I think.
They're getting a TV series. When Real Steel came out, it's a movie with Hugh Jackman as a deadbeat dad who's also a robot boxer. Mm. And it's a really good movie. Like, I like that movie a lot, but it was kind of a weird culty thing, and it didn't make a lot of money. And the reason why we're getting a follow-up TV series now is because it got a cult audience. People just wouldn't stop talking about it. It was made consistently low-key successful. So I feel like we're getting that now. We're getting that constantly. I feel like that's what Valerian was. That's what Monster Trucks was. And it's just they don't make money when you throw that much money at them.
But they do if you consider that comic books used to be considered fodder for B-movie series, like Saturday morning serials.
True.
Mostly that was like a technology thing. We didn't have the special effects to make superheroes look that great on screen.
Oh, yeah. Spider-Man would have looked terrible. And did, actually. They did a live-action Spider-Man in the 70s. The late 90s.
When they did Superman in the late 70s, they put every dollar into that thing. That was a hugely expensive production.
The tagline was, you will believe a man can fly, because before then you wouldn't.
Yeah, people made fun of George Reeves because he looked silly in the outfit. And even George Reeves is rather infamously...
was rather ashamed of that. Yeah, not ashamed, but embarrassed.
Loathsome of that series.
Yeah, embarrassed of it,
They made a film about it called Hollywoodland, where Ben Affleck played George Reeves, and that's a pretty good movie, actually.
All the Ben Affleck stuff is great, but there's this,
the wraparound mystery isn't so
Adrian
interesting.
Adrian Brody's investigating, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was actually a murder or whatever like that. Mm. All of that shit, completely disposable, adds nothing to the film. All the Ben Affleck stuff is great. Ben Affleck should have been Oscar-nominated for that movie. He's really good.
But I'm thinking of something like a filmmaker like James Gunn, who was a cult filmmaker and was making these really completely insanely lurid, trashy movies for Troma back in the day.
And now he's doing that shit, and he's doing well with it, actually.
Well, he's making a lot of money with it, and he made, like, Guardians of the Galaxy, and also The Suicide Squad, the second one, not the first one. And
Peacemaker, he's doing that now, which apparently has much more of a lurid sensibility.
I haven't seen the TV show, but when you look at those movies, I think they're kind of hurt by their big budgets. Mm. That kind of dirty sense of humor and dark sensibility benefits from feeling like somebody's getting away with something.
Yeah.
That they're slipping it to you around the mainstream rather than being filtered through a big studio.
Yeah, I agree. I think we put way too much... We put too much emphasis on money in general. And I think if you're willing to meet a movie at least part of the way there, movies don't need to be cost nearly as much as they do.
Oh, goodness, no.
And I think that there's a lot of charm and there's a lot of excitement to be found when you're watching a movie that's trying to do a lot with a little. Mm. And I would also argue that the idea that, like, oh, wouldn't Robot Jocks be better if James Cameron did it? I disagree. I think a lot of the times the appeal of something like Robot Jocks isn't just that there are robot fights. Mm. It's that they're being made by someone who is eccentric and quirky and actually interested in making a movie like Robot Jocks at a time when no one else was interested in putting forth the effort to making a movie about giant robots fighting each other in 1989 on a very low budget. And I'm sorry, those robot fights look awesome.
Those robot fights are amazing.
Like, the rest of the movie around it, it's kind of just okay, but the robot fights are amazing.
I actually kind of like it is really low budget, but I do like the world that they managed to construct.
There's definitely good stuff in it.
There's a lot of little, Verhoevian details in the background. Yeah. There's a lot of posters around saying, be sure to reproduce, have a lot of kids. There's something wrong with the population of the planet.
Yeah.
And there's one scene where one of the main characters is invited over to dinner, and they're saying, what are we having? We're having meat tonight.
Real meat.
Real meat.
And it's one hot dog.
It's a single hot dog in this giant pot of stew. So there's a little bit of a dystopian element to that movie as well.
I just feel like if that was very mainstream, you probably wouldn't have those eccentricities that make Robot Jocks interesting.
Exactly.
Like, maybe if you got Joe Dante to do it, but so many of them.
There's one cult filmmaker who I feel like would always have benefited from a bigger budget, and that's Don Coscarelli.
That's fair.
I like Phantasm a lot. I think he did well with what little he had with Phantasm.
Yeah.
But you watch something like The Beastmaster, or especially John Dies at the End, which is this big, epic sort of dimension-hopping thing with, creatures in multiple dimensions, and people are taking drugs and hallucinating other dimensions. That's straining against the limits of its budget. It's supposed to be gigantic kingdom halls and all the rest. And it's just people walking through a park.
What about the opposite? What if there's take a lot of the cult, we're talking about cult movies that are kind of good on their own terms.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cult movies that are kind of good. Ironically, they're kind of, people are appreciating them, perhaps not on the level on which they were intended, but at least they're appreciated. Take the works of, for example, the majority of the works of Ed Wood.
Okay.
Look at something like Plan 9 from Outer Space. If Ed Wood had money...
Had, time and money.
If he had actual time and money to make that, that would probably still be interesting because it would still be Ed Wood making it. And he still is a very weird storyteller. But I kind of would have been fascinated to see what Ed Wood could have done with money.
I would like to see, because if Ed Wood had a lot of money, he'd be working probably for a big studio, right? He wouldn't just be some independent contractor.
Probably not. Probably not.
Which would mean he'd have a lot more studio oversight.
Yeah.
Which means there would be a lot more interference on his script.
That's true.
There'd be a lot of people running, doing rewrites and punch up and everything. So
demanding reshoots.
The script would ostensibly make sense, because the way it is, it doesn't make a lick of sense.
Right.
And that's why we like it.
Good point.
We like it because it's actually kind of shoddily put together and kind of nonsensically written.
Yeah. The cult movies are kind of an antidote to the mainstream.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we need them. Yeah, I think that's why we crave them.
When you pour money into it, it doesn't really matter if the content is the same.
Yeah.
The sensibility is different. When you watch a cult movie, you're not only getting this quirky story of these weirdo characters that wouldn't fit in a mainstream Hollywood film.
Right.
But you also get that story, the sort of sub-narrative from the filmmaker themselves.
Yeah, you get that freedom.
Also a quirky weirdo.
You get that freedom to not work by committee and make weird choices that may or may not work.
Would Herschel Gordon Lewis have made something like 2000 Maniacs? If he had had a big budget and studio oversight? No, he didn't want to.
No, that's true. He only made gore because it was the only way he could make money.
Yeah, he could make money with gore. Would he have made money if he had made other kinds of films if he had money? Maybe. Yeah. Who's to say what kind of filmmaker he would have been?
Yeah.
I'm really interested in the kinds of filmmakers who have had both small and big budgets. Mm. People like Joe Dante, who I think works really well with both.
True.
Then you have people like Sam Raimi, who I think is far more interesting when he has lower budgets.
Agreed.
Ditto Peter Jackson. I think his low-budget movies are a lot more interesting.
Yeah.
But then you have somebody like Spielberg or James Cameron, who function a lot better when they do have unlimited budgets.
That's true. They do... When they have every tool in the toolbox, they're able to create something a bit stronger than... I mean, granted, they made amazing stuff when they were working on low budgets, but they never... They never let technology make them complacent. They always pushed.
Yeah.
And I think that made them exciting. I agree. Anyway, I would love
to see the cult film, the low-budget cult film that George Lucas makes today.
I know.
I feel like we lost George Lucas at some point. He made Star Wars and he just disappeared.
Well, he produced a lot of interesting stuff. With Lucasfilm?
He did, but I think Lucasfilm was still running on the steam of the success of Star Wars.
Mm.
So a lot of the things he produced were very reminiscent of Star Wars stuff, like Willow and Strange Magic.
You're thinking about the big stuff, though. I'm talking about the little stuff, like Mishima, Life in Four Chapters.
Oh, was that a Lucasfilm?
Yes, it was a Lucasfilm. Or More American Graffiti, which is a very ambitious and artistically sequel. Yeah. Twice Upon a Time, which is a very unique animated film experience. He produced quite a few interesting things.
He produced Red Tails. That was like a historical picture. Yeah, so, which is not an adventure film.
No, it's quite good, actually. Yeah. I like that movie.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, the dialogue's, a little corny, but I feel like that's fine. Yeah, it works. Anyway, we should move on. Thank you for the letter. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we answered that to your satisfaction. I realize we took it in a slightly different direction, but we have a different take on the idea.
Here is a letter from Tim. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Hello there, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. Oh, you can call me Rockmeister McCool.
Please.
If you wish.
Call him Rockmai.
I hope this finds you in good health-ish. Yeah. I'm not sick, I'm just exhausted. I'm tired. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm. I had a question about film producers and Oscar discourse.
Ah.
I personally don't really pay attention to the Oscars, but I'm connected with film Twitter and get a lot of movie news and discourse that way. Recently, I saw people bringing up an argument I've seen before but hadn't really considered. The argument slash question is, how does it make sense that a film can win Best Picture, but the director may not win Best Director at the same time?
Ah.
I googled this a little and learned that when a film wins Best Picture, the producers take home the award. This is true.
Mm-hmm.
I can see how this makes sense, but I also realize when I'm thinking about a movie and all the talented people working together to make it happen, I, perhaps many people, like many people who engage in this discourse, never consider the producer,
mm-hmm.
nor have I ever had a friend who said, yo, you should see this film. It's produced by blank. I've said this on occasion in reference to movie studios like Blumhouse, but not individual producers. This is a blind spot I hadn't really noticed before. My questions are twofold. Do you feel that producers ought to get much more credit, recognition, or fame for their work? And what are your thoughts on the director deserves credit for Best Picture discourse? Thanks for all the hard work you do in making your podcasts, Tim.
Yeah, no worries. Those are two kind of different questions. So which one do you want to take first?
I guess let's talk about sort of the producer's award.
Yeah.
When it comes to Best Picture of the Year, you're kind of giving the award to everybody who worked on it, aren't you?
Kind of. It's symbolic to a lot of it, yeah.
But the manager, the boss of the whole production, is going to be the producer.
Indeed. And there is no Best Producer Academy Award.
That's what Best Picture is.
I know. Perhaps it should be called that, but then we don't really have Best Picture.
Well, it's you have Best Direction, and the Best Picture would be Best Production, wouldn't it?
And now, a producer is a bit of an amorphous thing. There are a lot of people who are producers and do different jobs or take on different responsibilities. That's why oftentimes there are many producers. But a producer's job, essentially, is to put together the whole production and to basically say, hey, let's make this movie. Let's hire that director. Mm. Here's their budget. I can raise that budget. I can sell this overseas.
And even the producer will take a pass at the script and say, oftentimes, this is a great script, but we need to cut this scene. Mm. I'll hire this writer to do a little punch-up.
Some producers are more hands-on than others. Some producers are kind of just there because by adding clout to the movie, like a big actor might be a producer without actually doing very much behind the scenes.
But their name is now
attached but because I'm just throwing a name out there, I don't know how true this is, but because Brad Pitt is attached, we can make more money than if we didn't have Brad Pitt attached. Right. So he becomes a producer. A producer's job is very important.
All of those things bring to it's not just a director. A film is not just the creative elements. It's actually a lot of organizing and bureaucracy.
Yeah.
It's a lot of gathering the team together.
Yeah.
And that's an important job. That's why the producer gets credit for Best Picture, because they're the ones who are ultimately overseeing the whole of the production.
Exactly. And let's also be clear here, especially in larger productions, directors are often also the producer on the picture. Mm-hmm. Not universally, but often. James Cameron, for example, won Best Director for Titanic and then proceeded to win a producing award for Titanic. Mm. Also happens.
That's not always the case.
No, it is not always the case.
Sometimes the director is only interested in the creative element, and that's what the audience is responding to. The direction, the editing, the cinematography, the acting.
Yeah, Best Producing as an award is a much more industry award. The audience doesn't really... they know how the film came together, but they don't necessarily know the work that went into that. Whereas almost every other Academy Award, Best Sound, well, I can hear that. Mm. Best Costume Design, I can see those costumes. Best Acting, I can see that performance. You don't necessarily see a person who wrangled a location we weren't supposed to be able to get, but made a lot of deals in order to make that happen, and money exchange hands, and also they were able to get a cinematographer out of a previous contract. So I'm like, there's a lot of things that go into making a movie that a director shouldn't have to worry about, because they're worried about telling the story.
They're shooting the script. They're busy making the movie itself.
And to be fair, there's a lot of crappy producers who will basically just throw their name on a project and be shitty about it, or will sometimes ruin a film. There's also a lot of crappy directors, a lot of crappy actors. There's crappy people at any job, so...
With the Avengers series, that's changing a lot, because the individual directors, I think, matter less to those movies than the producer. And that is a man named Kevin Feige.
In that particular instance, yes. That's,
because that series of films is, this is old news at this point, but they're produced like a television series.
Yeah.
Where each individual episode might have an individual director, but they are strung together as if they're going to connect to a season finale eventually. And that's the way what Kevin Feige is overseeing.
Yeah.
The story and the arc and the characters and everything, the way all of these stories are interconnect, aren't being written by a single ambitious screenwriter or a team of screenwriters.
Yeah.
They're come together by Kevin Feige, who then hires the screenwriters.
Let's not give him too much credit. He's got a whole team. But regardless, the buck stops there. When you say something like, oh, I never go see a movie because it was produced by a certain person, if you'll go see anything MCU, you will. Because it's ultimately Kevin Feige. And there aren't many over the course of history, but there have been super producers.
Selznick, Robert Evans is another one.
Yep, George Lucas as well. To a very different extent in a very different field, Corman. Mm. You know, Corman's name has a certain schlock and premature. And of course, back in the old days of the studio system, you brought up Selznick, the producers ran the whole studio. It was basically the studio that was going to win that award. So, there's Best Picture goes to that figurehead type role that may or may not include the director. Multiple producers are usually awarded for every single film. And in fact, there's oftentimes, there's actually a limit. I think it's like three. Unless there's like extenuating circumstances, like a maximum of three producers can get an Oscar right now. There's more producers than that.
But this goes to the second part of the question, which is why aren't directors awarded for Best Picture?
Yeah.
Because it's a completely different discipline. Directing is a very specific art. We're still really stuck in a lot of modern discourse on auteur theory.
We are.
The idea that there should be a single author behind a film production. And
it's a collaborative medium, but there's one person.
There's one person who's going to ultimately have all the creative say. And since at least the 1950s, it's been sort of the primary way of thinking about the movie as the director is the one author, is the final author of the
thing. We like to think of it like, oh, it's Steven Spielberg's West Side Story. It's John Carpenter's Halloween.
There have been movements in the past to get directors credited for Best Picture. There have also been efforts to get the screenwriter's name above the title of the film. So instead of going to see Steven Spielberg's West Side Story, you'd be seeing Tony Kushner's West Side Story, because he was the one who wrote the screenplay.
And there are a few very noteworthy screenwriters who've been able to get that, people like Neil Simon.
Yeah.
Like, Neil Simon's The Odd Couple. Like, he was just that well-known. Arthur Miller's The Crucible.
Kevin Smith is another one. Better known.
He's also a director.
He's directing, but he's better known for his writing. For better or for worse, Joss Whedon is another one of those people. He's best known for his writing than his directing.
Yeah, fair enough. Because his directing is okay at best.
I mean, he did a completely competent job on that Avengers film. The first one.
He made that thing work. I'll give him that. But at the same time, it's not an impressive cinema. It's just he kept all the pieces together, which is no small feat, but it's
slick entertainment.
Yeah, I'm just not super impressed by his directorial storytelling talent. He just kind of got out of the way and let the characters do what they did.
Yeah, the direction is a different discipline from writing, is a different discipline from acting. Best Picture is going to be all of those disciplines put together, hence Best Production. So they give it to the producer because they're ostensibly the ones who got all those elements together.
Right. A lot of people are saying right now something to the effect of, like, Dune was nominated for Best Picture, but Denis Villeneuve was not nominated for Best Director. What? Did the movie direct itself? Yeah. And what I'm not hearing is people say, like, oh, Nightmare Alley was nominated for Best Picture. Mm. Guillermo del Toro wasn't nominated. Did Nightmare Alley direct it? No, you're picking your battle.
Yeah,
you're picking your battle. And to be fair, I'm not a huge fan of Dune. I'm going to say this right now. I don't think the storytelling in Dune is anything more than clear, which, to be fair, is not a small feat given how complex Dune is.
It's impossible. Impossible to tell kind of story.
I will give you that. Mm. It's a complicated story, and he made it clear. I'm also not very impressed by that. I think that's kind of like the baseline you could ask for. But what I will say in the case of Dune, that's an impressive production. Mm. The scale of it, the impressive cast that they put together, all of the production that they put together, every single aspect of the production is impressive. The thing that I'm least impressed with in that movie is the storytelling. So ultimately, that one makes perfect sense to me that Denis Villeneuve wasn't nominated for Best Director, even though the picture was. If he was nominated, would I be mad? Maybe, but I'd be in the minority on that. But I think in that case, I get that. I think that is more impressive from a production angle than from a directorial angle. Because ultimately, I see nothing in that movie that I... Basically, if you said, hey, what would a Denis Villeneuve Dune look like? I imagine that. Like, I don't. Exactly. Exactly what I expected him to do with it. And while that's not... It's not incompetent or anything. It's not bad per se. I'm also not terribly impressed by it. Whereas I was impressed when he did Arrival. I think Arrival is done with so much sensitivity and so much nuance that I think sometimes Denis Villeneuve doesn't feel the need to get to. He's a very literal filmmaker in a lot of ways. I feel like in that case, he really pushed himself, and he actually deserved an Oscar nomination for that, which he got.
He was the perfect director to do another Blade Runner film, because he and Blade Runner's director, Ridley Scott, are both master stylists who are only going to be as good as their screenplay.
Yeah.
They don't really care about the script or the story. They're going to shoot the scene they think looks the best.
And to be fair, I want to make this abundantly clear. When I talk about, like, oh, Denis Villeneuve, you know, maybe didn't, if him leaving him out of Best Director isn't so bad. It's also important to remember that Denis Villeneuve is nominated for Best Picture for Dune.
Because he produced it.
And Best Adapted Screenplay. So he's covered. He still might actually get one of those. Like, he's definitely been honored for his work.
We're going to finish off this conversation we do need to remember that when we do get into these heated arguments about the Oscars and what should and should not be nominated, we are just playing fandom games. This is the who would win in a fight. This is James
Bond fantasy versus football.
Indiana Jones versus James Bond kind of conversation. Yeah. Except
it's actually kind of happening.
Kind of, but the point is we're picking our fandom, aren't we? Yeah. This is just fandom conversation.
Yeah, it is a popularity contest.
And that's fun.
Yeah.
Conversations.
There's a lot of things that I criticize that I still am able to enjoy on some level. Mm-hmm. The Oscars are one of them. There's a lot to criticize with the Oscars. I still enjoy the conversation about them. Yeah. It's easy for me to get wrapped up in it. Same thing with, talking about Disney. As a corporation, Disney does a lot of things that I think are entirely worthy of criticism, and in some cases I think are just abhorrent. Mm. They also produce a lot of works of art from a lot of different people, and I think some of them are really great, and I can talk about that, and I can appreciate that. So, it's complicated. It's a complicated dynamic there. But in any case, I hope that answers your question. I get that it's weird, but hopefully that covers it. What do we got next?
Here's a letter from David. Hello, David.
Hey, David.
Dear Bridget and Whitney, I hope you fine gentlemen are both doing well and staying safe and healthy. I loved your recent review of Joachim Trier's The Worst Person in the World.
Oh, cool.
And in person, your discussion of how it's a great movie about what it's like to be in your 20s. Whilst I didn't absolutely love the film overall in the way that some others have, one aspect I really did love was its depiction of the quarter-life crisis point in one's life.
Yeah.
As someone who has just turned 26 years old, is single and is suddenly seeing all the people they grew up with either getting married or having kids, this movie hits points in a hard yet moving way. I liked your comparisons to Francis Ha, one of my favorite movies, and Metropolitan, a film that has been on my watch list for a while. I wanted to ask, what other movies about being in your 20s do you love and recommend? I feel like Kelly Reichardt's Old Joy, although I'm 100% certain, I'm not 100% certain of the character's ages, also fits nicely into this category, as does another Noah Baumbach film, Mistress America. That's one I would actually recommend.
Oh, I actually really like that movie a lot,
But I'd love to hear any similar suggestions that I can add to my watch list. Thanks for taking the time to read my letter. And thanks for all the amazing weekly shows you gift us with. Best,
thank you so
David.
Much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good question. That's something that people didn't used to talk about the quarter-life crisis very often when I was growing up. It kind of took me by surprise when I was in my 20s.
It's a phenomenon that only recently was given a name.
Yeah.
This sort of mid-20s malaise of... lack of confidence over your lack of success to your point, your life up to this point.
Well, for me, in my particular case, what it felt to me was like, and your mileage might vary, and if you're young enough that you haven't hit this yet, get ready. But for me, you know, I was in school. I had structure until my mid to late 20s. And then when I was now on my own devices, and it's basically like, okay, cool, here's your diploma. Figure your shit out. And I'm like, oh, weren't you supposed to help with that? No, we gave you a structure that will be of no use whatsoever from now on. And I'm like, oh, so what do I do? You're going to have to figure that out. Like, that's the first thing you got to do is figure out what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, shit. So unless you have, like, a very clear career path ahead of you based on what you studied, it's very easy to fall into that malaise and go, like, what the fuck do I do now? Like, and I got trapped there for a few years.
I would recommend... one of my favorite films of last year, Tick, Tick, Boom.
Oh, that's a good one.
Which is very much about... the opening song is called 3090. It's about Jonathan Larson is turning 30, and he realizes that he's not successful. And it's very much about that time in history, about 1990 in particular. But it's also about how he hasn't achieved success yet, and he needs to do it right, and he actually has... other options to achieve success, but he needs to do it right. And I think by his own standard, that is.
A film I have often related to, even though I think parts of it have aged poorly, but there's an undercurrent of truth, I think, in Kevin Smith's Clerks.
I would say Clerks 2.
Clerks 2 deals
that with it a little
crisis,
bit.
Though.
Okay.
I think Clerks 2 was like 20 years later. I think Clerks 1 is about we're out of high school, we've got jobs... what do we do now? Do we get complacent? Do we accept that we are now merely a cog in the industry? Or do we allow our existential crisis to drive us to anarchy? Or at the very least, think outside the box and change our circumstances? It's a movie about being trapped in a job.
Yeah.
And a job with no future whatsoever. And that's a place we think we all find ourselves at once in a while.
Yeah.
And although much of the humor is... offensive to the point of he's just young and trying to get noticed. That's no need to be that gross. The undercurrent of existential crisis and like sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Like the I guess malaise is the best. The sort of I'm almost mature, but I haven't figured out how to take the next step into that.
Yeah.
I always connect to that every time I watch that movie. So it's imperfect, but there's a lot I really really like about it.
On the comedy front, all of the films of Judd Apatow are about people in their mid-20s, even into their mid-30s, wrestling with maturity and their lack thereof, and how this is sort of making their... They've reached a point where their immaturity isn't cute anymore. This is every film made by Whit Stillman.
Also
not,
true.
Yeah, not just Metropolitan, but pretty much all of his movies, even Love and Friendship, to a degree, deals with this. What are some others?
Antoine and Colette? Oh, wait, not Antoine and Colette. That's the short film. Stolen Kisses.
Oh, there you go. Excellent choice.
Francois Truffaut, his first film was a breakout French New Wave success. It's called 400 Blows. It's about a young boy who's just sort of... his parents are getting divorced, and he's just kind of running around and skipping school, and just seems to have no place in life. Everyone treats him like a delinquent, but he's actually kind of bright. And he doesn't know what to do with himself. And that's kind of it. That's just his childhood. Fantastic movie about feeling lost when you're young. And then Truffaut kept following that character along.
Yeah.
And in Stolen Kisses, which is the third... It's the third...
Technically the third.
Technically the third film, but the second film was like a short. He's basically... he's been dishonorably discharged from the Marines or whatever the equivalent is in France. And he has a bunch of different really shitty affairs. He tries to become a private detective. Like, he's just struggling and aimlessly like attempting to find some direction. The third film in the Apu trilogy is another one of those as well.
I'm not sure if it's a quarter-life crisis. It's more about him finally...
I guess it's
like
more it's
accepting his fatherhood, but
I guess that's probably more true.
Lena Dunham made her, I think it was her first feature, was Tiny Furniture.
I never saw
it. It's about that. Another artist who's just sort of reached that point where she's like Frances Ha, like Whit Stillman, where your struggle to become an artist and couch surfing and living kind of a bohemian life isn't seemly any longer.
Daisy von Schurler-Meyer made a film that was briefly all anyone could talk about in the mid-90s and has quickly been forgotten, unfortunately, but it's Party Girl with Parker Posey, where her whole thing is she's a party girl. She goes out and she parties, whatever, and eventually she like slowly starts getting her life together when she ends up having to get a job at a library. It works. It works. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I was a big, big fan.
I wouldn't call it Ghost World. They're not old enough.
No, that's high school. That's high school. That's not the same vibe. One could maybe argue Lost in Translation. Someone who got married younger than perhaps they were ready for.
The World's End.
That's still midlife crisis.
Yes, that's more midlife. Well, I guess
I would say Shaun of the Dead
is more quarter life crisis.
That's a perfect quarter life crisis movie. That's a movie in which someone has like a list of things they need to do to get their shit together, and because of the zombie apocalypse, they have to do them all in one day.
Pretty much.
It's basically he has to grow into a fully mature adult over the course of one day because of a crisis. That's why I still think that's arguably Edgar Wright's best movie. It's really grounded in something real, even though the humor is very silly.
And to continue with Edgar Wright, he also made a film called Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, which is very much a quarter-life crisis movie. It's not a movie I like. I actually have a lot of major issues with that movie.
I think the manga works better than the movie.
I'm sure it does. I haven't read the comics, but the movie condenses things to the point where it's
nothing senseless. Nothing has emotional resonance because it all happens too fast.
A streak of biphobia that I just hate in that movie. But yeah, it's about the lead character, Scott Pilgrim, is about trying to sort of come to terms with the fact that he has to do something besides be a cool guy. And I think the movie doesn't ever have him face that. He just continues to think that his only goal is to be a cool guy, even up to the end. So it doesn't handle it presents the crisis, but it doesn't present like maturity or change.
I agree. I think it's a flawed film. Great style, but not necessarily great.
No, the style is amazing, and the cast is great, and it's hilarious. But I don't like it.
No, I can appreciate that. And you've won me over the years on that. I used to be really high on that movie, but now every time I watch it, I think about it from your perspective, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't actually all that great if you think about it. It's just it just looks really cool.
There are plenty of movies out there that do look at the experience of being in your mid-20s and the fear you feel that you're not far enough along.
Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah, I guess so.
Jack Nicholson is like this workaday guy. He's got unimaginative relationships. He's got like shitty down-to-earth jobs. And what's interesting about it is over the course of the film, you realize he's actually he's a piano prodigy who is running away from his talent. And that's an interesting example of that. It's interesting the way that they sort of introduce that over time, where you sort of get used to the idea that you know this guy, and what you really don't realize is that, no, he's actually like a wunderkind. I know, that movie's really great. Anyway, hopefully that gives you some examples. let's move on, I guess.
All right. Here's a follow-up letter from OK. OK wrote into us. OK was going to start
a film club.
Like a film club, and I think this is a little bit of a follow-up on that, so let's follow up. Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I guess it's still okay to call people dear on letters, but I guess you find it quite weird if I met and I would be doing it to your faces. Hello, dear.
Well.
But that doesn't matter, and it's not why I'm writing. I wrote earlier about my potential movie club at our local culture workshop. I had my practice section with it on Tuesday the 8th, and it went really well.
Yay!
Hooray. Though I was nervous about it, I was able to get into it, and people seemed to respond quite well to my presentation. Also, one of the best things was hearing people laughing during the movie I chose. It gave me a really nice feeling of community. As I told you in my previous letter, the film showed me the practice session was Disney's Steamboat Willie. I didn't do a ton of research for us because I tried to keep it more fun for me, especially considering I don't get paid for it.
Right.
But I spoke about how the film was considered the first successful cartoon with synchronized sound, and a bit about how during the production the animators were doubtful of a cartoon with sound working. But based on the feedback I got my presentation did, and it did indeed raise the enjoyment of the movie for the people who are allowed to see it and focus on the things that made Steamboat Willie a success and a classic. I attached some slides from my presentation.
Oh, cool.
Some images on this email here. Just in case you're curious, of course it's in Finnish, but I think the picture can give some idea about what was going on. Also to explain the color scheme and the pig, I used similar graphics on my YouTube channel. Anyway, I did get confirmation today that as long as I just attend the training to the end and feel myself ready for it, I will get to start to do the actual group when the next period starts, when the culture workshop starts.
That's great.
The period lasts for 5 weeks, after which there's a week of planning, and the next period and groups usually operate once a week. Next period is at the turn of the month, so I'll be back quite soon. For my first period, I've already started to think about films to show. It's surprisingly hard to decide when you want to show a diverse group of films that to as many people as possible, and that they would feel comfortable to join for at least one meeting. Currently, I'm thinking of showing the following. Number one, Hayao Miyazaki's Castle in the Sky. For its influential animation, I hear about and I don't hear about it as often as some other Studio Ghibli films.
That's an interesting choice, because a lot of people love Hayao Miyazaki, but that one doesn't get shown very often. You can see with the audience very often.
Spirited Away, or Princess Mononoke, or Kiki's Totoro.
Or Totoro, more common, yeah. So that's an interesting choice. I like that choice. Yeah,
it's also based on Gulliver's Travels.
You're right, it is actually a little bit. Yeah, sorry about that, yeah. In a roundabout way, but yeah.
Number two, The Harder They Fall. Because it's fucking awesome.
It is fucking awesome.
One of my favorites of 2021 that I just wanted to share with people. Number three, Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress. I have this nice Kurosawa Samurai collection of Blu-rays and figured Hidden Fortress would be a fun place to start for its Star Wars connection, because Seven Samurai is way too long and Rashomon is a bit too rough with its assault scenes.
Yeah, that's not for everybody. Whereas Hidden Fortress is a little bit...
It's raucous. The
intensity isn't as harrowing.
It's
Hidden Fortress.
It moves a little bit more sprightly. There's a lot of fighting.
It's an adventure film. It's an adventure film. It's a good one too. It's one of the best.
Awesome photography.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I've loved Kurosawa. No matter who is his photographer, I love the way Kurosawa shot movies. Number four, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yay!
Because it's still really funny, and I wanted to do something comedic too.
Yeah. Good history in that movie.
Good history. It's a bit dangerous just because it's so widely seen. You don't want to necessarily throw in a ringer.
A lot of people will be like, I've seen that a million times.
I happen to love the movie, but I understand. I'm not going to go out of my way to see it at midnight.
On the other hand, I think it's important not to take that for granted. I think some movies we take for granted as being old staples, but if younger audiences aren't being exposed to them as often, maybe this actually might be something like, oh, I've always meant to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail because I was born in 2000, and it wasn't as ubiquitous in their generation as it was in ours.
Yeah,
so maybe it is. Maybe it is a good idea.
Okay.
Yeah. Never take it for granted.
And slot number five is undecided. I'll be looking forward to the possibilities of taking the group to a movie theater, maybe letting the group choose. I know you have a review of The Harder They Fall on Critically Acclaimed, and Episode Zero did Hidden Fortress, but do you have any interesting thoughts on Holy Grail or Castle in the Sky? This email is getting long. It always does. That's not a dig at you. We just don't mind reading long emails.
We don't mind at all.
But I'll bring up something else as well. Feel free to cut the second section if time demands. You are our demand. We're going to read it. We're going to cut it for time.
My God.
We're here to take time for you. sounded dejected.
Guttural. Like,
I told you in one earlier letter that I do a little reviews of films and TV shows on YouTube as a hobby, and that I've been allowed to attend press screenings for upcoming movies.
Cool.
Another exciting opportunity is coming up next Tuesday, on the 15th of February, the date of this recording, in fact. After a press screening of the horror movie Hatching, I'm going to interview the director of the film, Hannah Bergholm.
Oh.
Considering this is my first time interviewing a director, I'm anxious as hell, but also excited, knowing that both of you have done some interviews with directors and other industry people before. I was wondering if you have some general tips or advice to give. Of course, there are differences between how they're handled in the US and in Finland, but I'm curious, and though I probably won't hear from you before the 15th, it still might help if I ever decided to do it again. After having said all that, I wanted to remind you that you're both awesome and thank you for all your amazing podcasts. Sending love and respect. Okay, and here's some of these slides in Finnish of Steamboat Willie that
that's
that fun. Okay showed during the presentation.
Oh, that looks really professional. Yeah. Good job. Real fast, let's because I actually really do like the second prompt, which is how to interview people, which is something mm-hmm. that I was very chagrined to discover when I got into this industry. There's like no book about that.
Oh goodness, no.
There's no like textbook about how to conduct like a celebrity interview, and I was very frustrated. And so I've paid attention my whole career, and I've got some thoughts on that. Real fast though, we did actually talk about Monty Python and the Holy Grail pretty recently when mm-hmm. we did our Iron List of the best movies based on TV shows.
Yeah.
So you can hear some of our thoughts there. In short, it's one of the funniest movies ever made, but one of the reasons why it's great is because it's actually steeped in a real awareness of British history, mm. both actual historical and mythological, and they mined the silliness and ridiculousness mm. and unfairness of history for some real vicious yeah. satire.
Some of my favorite comedies are dumb comedies written by very smart people.
Exactly.
Feel the same way about Futurama. Those are all science nerds, and you can tell.
Yeah.
One of the writers, his name is Keeler. His last name is Keeler.
Yeah.
He likes to write his name into the scripts. They're visiting the planet Saturn. They're sailing across the rings. There's a little sign next to the gap in the rings that says, "Mind the Keeler Gap."
Uh-huh.
That's a joke on Mind the Gap
uh-huh.
that you hear on the British subway system.
Right.
And the Keeler Gap, which is the name of that actual gap in the rings.
Oh, that's funny.
And it's also the name of the screenwriter. So, wow. So it's a triple joke.
A lot of work in there.
Smart people thinking these things ahead. They know a lot about shit.
What was the other movie he asked us to talk about?
The other one was...
was it Castle in the Sky?
We did the Heart of the... Yeah, Castle in the Sky.
Yeah.
Because it's one of Miyazaki's less talked about movies.
Yeah.
Not that it's not celebrated. It did get distribution. It was on, you know, retrospectives and screenings. And
it never really inspired the same fan base. I suspect that's partly because it doesn't really have like a lot of breakout characters. It's got a really mm-hmm. awesome robot in it. And mm-hmm. I love the Sky Pirates.
Yeah.
Those are really, really fun. But I would argue the Sky Pirates and Porco Rosso are even more fun.
I'll say this. It was my first Miyazaki.
Oh.
My roommate in college was head of the anime club. So I got, you know, a little bit privileged information. So I got to see Castle in the Sky, like, right before or right when Miyazaki mm-hmm. was becoming a household name in the United States. So I got to see Castle in the Sky, like, in 96, which was, like, shortly before Princess Mononoke hit stateside.
Mm-hmm.
And, what really impressed me was the flight. That's all. That's Miyazaki's thing. Awesome. He just loves. He's so good at capturing flying through the air.
Yeah.
I don't know how he does it. Live action films get shots of actual planes don't do it in the same way.
Agreed. Yeah.
Like he does a lot of that in Kiki. There's a lot of flying scenes in all his
movies. If I ever directed a Superman movie, I would tell the VFX department, look at everything he has. Flying looks like.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want anything that doesn't look like this.
And of course. Kind of his big personal masterpiece, The Wind Rises, is about a designer of airplanes that were ultimately used for nefarious purposes.
Yeah, it's very difficult to film in a lot of ways.
Which is why I like it. The morals are not so clear-cut in that movie, but it's also very calm and placid and full of love, but it's also advocating something that was very destructive. Knowingly doing that.
It's not propaganda. Questions. Yeah,
but yeah, I think Laputa, Castle in the Sky, which is its original full title, which takes its name from Gulliver's Travels, does that flying stuff really, really well.
Great.
So when somebody's on an engine that's barely, like, it's just a plane engine with, like, little wings on the side, and they're kind of, like, revving the engine to stay up, and you think they're going to plummet any minute, you feel that in your gut.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those beautiful visuals, and when they finally get to the Castle in the Sky, there's this very lush, peaceful, like, placid feeling, this garden-like feeling to wandering through this ruin. And, yeah, that robot is part of that ruin.
Very fun. Regarding how to interview a filmmaker. This is a great question, and we do not get asked this enough, because not enough people get the opportunity to do this, and I wish more people did, because it's really illuminating. When you're interviewing someone, you're trying to get them to reveal things about, in this case, their work, which means that your questions, if you do nothing else, the best advice I can give is to try not to ask yes or no questions. Don't ask, like, was it difficult to shoot on a boat?
Yeah.
Because the answer is probably yes. Because then you'll have to ask a follow-up question. Just say, tell me about the difficulties of filming on a boat. boom, now you've got them explaining things and telling stories. Your goal is to do as little talking as possible and get them to tell stories. That's the baseline. There's a lot more to it than that. But if you take nothing else away, if you, that's the only piece of advice you can keep in your head at any moment, boom.
If you can start your question with, could you tell me about...
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to start.
Or what was it like?
Yeah,
there, you know, put me in that. Put me on the day, you know.
And this is really important, and it took me way too long to learn this.
Hmm.
Have some questions like written down.
Yeah,
like know what you're going to talk about. Know what you want to ask them about.
Yeah,
but don't make a list of 10 and go down the list.
Oh yeah.
Listen to what they're saying.
Yes.
Ask questions based on what they're saying. Have a conversation with them. Don't be afraid to come back with like a little bit of personal information about yourself,
mm-hmm.
and how you reacted to a certain thing about what they just said, and you know,
yeah.
how they're going to come back at you.
That's really important. Yeah. Listen to what they're saying. There's nothing
more
frustrating.
Don't just record their answers.
Yeah. There's nothing more frustrating to me because especially early on when I didn't know what I was doing, and you know, I was just trying to, and I did okay, but like, you know, I realized I could do better. I would do that. I would just ask the questions that I had, and then I was like transcribing it, and I realized they said something really interesting, and I didn't think to ask a follow-up question.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in the moment. You have the questions written down. You can always refer back to them, but try to stay in the moment. Listen to what they're saying. If they mention something really interesting but don't go into detail, bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
Another great way to talk about, get them talking about films is to talk about very specific creative decisions. Don't just talk about like, oh, how, you made a horror movie. How do you feel about horror movies? Instead, say something really specific about a creative choice that they made in the movie, which is something like, how did you decide that vampire fangs would look like that instead of what they normally look like? And then all of a sudden, they're actually trying to explain a creative decision, which is probably really important to the film.
And understand a lot about their discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I find when, and I'm not sure if this is exciting to read about, but I know actors love talking about their craft.
Yeah.
Their approach to a character, their the way they looked at the script, how, you know, the rehearsal process, how they got into character, what they felt, the kind of research they did.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing I like to ask actors about because they're usually excited to talk about that kind of thing.
And it's tricky because talking to actors is very different than usually than talking to directors or writers because actors typically aren't responsible for the same overall creative decisions.
No.
So if you ask an actor about the plot, they may or may not have an opinion about it, but there's a decent chance that's not in their purview and they don't have a strong opinion about it. And what they can tell you about is the acting parts. They can tell you about their character. They can tell you about their wardrobe. They can tell you about decisions that their character made.
Yeah.
But they can't necessarily tell you about... There's someone that said, like, oh, someone asked Harrison Ford in an interview whether Han Solo was a Force ghost at the end of Rise of Skywalker. And his response was basically, I don't care.
I don't care.
It's irrelevant to me. I was in the moment with my son.
Talk to me
about that relationship and you might have something. So, yeah, so actors, slightly different than filmmakers, from directors and writers.
Mm.
Generally speaking, I tend to prefer interviewing directors and writers because they get to make bigger creative decisions and because they can,
quote, idea people.
They can tell you avenues that they almost went down. Mm. They can tell you the reason why a movie makes a decision, even if you don't agree with it.
I got to interview Triple H, the wrestler, at one point.
That's great.
Who was in? I even forgot the title of the movie. But he was in this action picture where it's very much like Die Hard with a Vengeance, where he's on the phone with the bad guy.
Oh, was it like 12 Rounds 2? 12 Rounds 1 was John Cena.
Then it was 12 Rounds 2.
Yeah, I think it was 12 Rounds 2.
I got to interview Triple H about 12 Rounds 2. Don't ask.
The original 12 Rounds ain't bad, by the way. I'll say that right now. It's kind of a fun flick.
But I said, you know, what was, you know, if you're on the phone with the bad guy, like, what are you picturing when you're acting? How much did you know? How much did you interact with the other actor? He revealed that they hadn't even cast or shot the scenes that he's acting opposite when he was doing his scenes. So they actually didn't have a bad guy yet. So he's like, well, this is what I was picturing. And it's like, yeah, I know there was this movie called Manhunter, a Michael Mann movie, where the director deliberately kept them apart until the last scene where the actors see each other for the first time so he could get a really genuine reaction when they see each other for the first time. Mm. He's like, really? Tell me more about that Manhunter movie. He'd never heard of it before.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
So I like to think I got Triple H to watch Manhunter
for
the first time.
I'm actually not sure what you interviewed him for because I'm not seeing any of the 12 Rounds movies on his filmography. another great trick to have in your bag of tricks when you're interviewing a filmmaker, make sure if you don't always have time. sometimes you just interviewing someone because it's available and you don't have time to do any research. Mm-hmm. If at all possible, do your research on the filmmaker, see all their other movies.
Yeah, that definitely helps.
It really is useful to be able to tie their new work into their old work. Maybe they have a recurring theme that pops up in a lot of their movies. Maybe there's a certain visual motif or certain people they work with a lot. And you can talk about their work not only in that movie, but previously. It's kind of, A, it's nice, it's flattering to your interview subject to know that you've paid attention to their whole work. Mm-hmm. But B, you know, they are not only thinking about their one film, they're thinking about everything they've ever done. So that's really useful. But if you can have a question in your back pocket that's kind of a fun one about something they've done in the past, that's also great. It kind of gets, because a lot of the interview questions they're going to get for any press tour are going to be pretty much the same thing over and over again. You know, where did this idea come from? What's it like working with so-and-so? Mm. Pretty boring, honestly. They have the same answer. They've given the same answer. The answer doesn't change. They've been it 20,000 times. But if you can ask them something weird, I interviewed William H. Macy once. Here's a good example here. It was before all that college scandal stuff came out.
Oh, but, my goodness.
Yeah, but I interviewed him for a different movie, and I asked him, because William H. Macy is one of those actors who, back in the 80s, before anyone knew who he was, would just pop up in things every once in a while. Mm. And he was in one of my favorite movies, Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon. He played like a stage manager in that Kung Fu Blaxploitation film. Great movie. Please see that movie.
And he's only in like one scene.
He's like one scene. Yeah. He's like one scene. But every time I watch that movie, I would be like, oh yeah, I forgot what William H. Macy's in this. And he is wearing, Google this, he's wearing the silliest coat. Like the most absurd mid-80s bizarre color scheme.
And he's not playing a bizarre character. No, 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 it's no, just no. The guy wearing this weird coat.
And I had to take a moment, and I was just like, so listen, while I have you here, I have a couple minutes left in our time. I remember you in The Last Dragon. And he was like, oh yeah, that was a long time ago. And I was like, cool, tell me about your jacket. And he was like, let me tell you about that jacket. Because he remembered that jacket. That jacket was the most absurd thing I think I've ever worn in a film, and I wish I'd stolen it because it cost more than they paid me.
Wow.
So if you pay attention to little stuff like that and you can bring that up, it's really, they remember and they want to tell the stories. So that's hopefully that's something you can work with. So, but the biggest thing of all, if nothing else, no yes, no questions, get them talking and listen and ask follow-up questions when appropriate. You'll be glad you did.
Yeah. And this is also important. Just relax.
Yeah. They're people too. They're just people.
They're just people. Yeah. You know, if you get dazzled or a little bit starstruck, that's fine. That's kind of natural, but
it happens.
If you just sort of approach them like a person you're going to have a conversation with, you're going to give a much better interview.
There's an attitude. You can't go overboard with this because you don't want to be rude. Mm. But I think it's something to remember when people are on a press tour, when they're like talking about or promoting their movie, they want to come across well. Mm. So you don't have to impress them. They're kind of here to impress your audience. Mm. So you just have to give them a forum for that.
And keep this in mind. And this is something that Gray Drake taught me. We've talked about Gray Drake's sort of tricks.
One of the great interviewers, period. Gray Drake.
She's a complete star. First of all, talk to them by their credited name. You don't have to say Mr. or Ms. If you're talking to Samuel L. Jackson, you say, hello, Samuel L. Jackson.
Say their whole name. Yeah, it's a great way to sound formal without going through that rigmarole of like, oh, don't call me Mr. Jackson. Samuel L. Jackson, great way to talk to somebody. Hello, Samuel L. Jackson. Boom.
But she pointed out that if you're going to have 10 minutes with an artist or even more so a celebrity, you're not going to crack them open, okay? You're not going to get the big scoop.
Yeah.
You're not going to get a big, long story. You're not going to get some behind-the-scenes anything.
You're not going to make them cry.
Don't try to get them.
It's not worth it.
It's not worth it. Just get to the end of the interview. Just have fun with it and have a conversation.
If you're having fun talking to them, other people probably will too. Just try to
a 30-minute podcast, you're still not going to get the big scoop.
Probably not.
Don't feel like you have to dig.
It's not about that. It's not about scoops. And I realize that's probably not what you specifically, the person who wrote in, is asking about. But like, it's not about scoops. It shouldn't be about scoops. If you have interesting things to talk about and they give you something newsworthy, great, all the better. But you cannot be fishing for that. A, they know you will. You'll get their guard up.
Yeah.
They'll be like, oh, this person's just fishing for news and they don't care about me as a person. Boom. They don't do that. Mm-hmm. All right. They'll just put their guard up, and then you've lost any opportunity you have to get a real conversation out of them. It is not worth it.
They'll give you the scoop if they want to.
Yeah.
There are some like actors or filmmakers who are eager to talk about
Kevin Feige, he does it less now than he used to, but he understands that everyone getting an interview with Kevin Feige wants some news about Marvel. Mm. And he's good with the tease. He knows how to say something in such a way that here's your headline. You know you want a headline. Here's something cool, you know?
You got to ask him about Motor Mouth at one point.
That was not a headline, but yeah, I got to ask him about Motor Mouth.
But he gave a very diplomatic answer.
I remember I got some scoops from him about Spider-Man, when Spider-Man was just a twinkle in Marvel's eye. I got scoops about Thor. I got scoops, and I got them directly from Kevin Feige because I talked to him about the creative process, and they came up organically.
Okay.
That's the best way to do it. Don't just say, tell me about Spider-Man. Mm. Say something about, like,
And he'll give his canned answer, which is, oh, just hang on.
Yeah, but if you ask something kind of specific in an odd way, something like, okay, so you've got Spider-Man, congratulations. Spider-Man's costume has been done multiple times in live action, and you probably don't want to do the exact same thing all over again. How do you approach that creative challenge?
Oh, there you go.
Boom.
Good.
So even if he doesn't have a specific, I'll tell you what we're going to do, it's going to be amazing, he's talking about a creative decision people are interested in the future, and you got that.
Yeah.
So at the very least, you have something. Mm. Boom. Anyway, long conversation. We could go on and on and on about it. Hopefully people found this interesting. I remember, again, when I started interviewing people for this job, I had nowhere to turn to other than a few people I know in the industry, including Gray Drake, who was wonderful, by the way. So I'm very sympathetic to people who all of a sudden have been asked to interview someone and don't know the etiquette or the best way to go about it. So hopefully that helps. Yeah. Anyway, but I hope you had a great time. I realize this is coming too late to be helpful, but hopefully next time it'll be even better. And I hope the first time was wonderful to start.
Yeah. And you can start strong. That's
easy. We have time for one more.
One more. Okay. Here's a letter from Kevin. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
To the two wonderful fellows at Critically Acclaimed.
Oh,
Who
I don't know. Yeah, yeah. Well, do we have other people here?
I think you're one of them, William.
No. I'm a piece of crap.
It's Luca and
Luca and Michelle.
Luca and Michelle.
Okay.
First, even if my question isn't used in an episode, I did want to express my gratitude. Thank you for all your hard work.
Oh, thanks.
Not only has your thoughtful analysis and sheer love of movies brought me joy and deepened my own movie-watching experience over the last few years, it has also helped me in my own professional trade. I am a Methodist pastor.
Oh, wow.
While my 7 years in theological schools were good and expensive, listening to good critics like yourselves break down art out loud and discuss elements of effective storytelling has been very educational.
Huh.
Listening to your conversations has helped broaden my perspectives and consider the creative choices one makes when crafting a story. My weird job involves a lot of reading and reflecting on stories, in my case, ancient scriptures, and then trying to find creative wells to retell or share what I find with others in the hopes that will help us all discover the divine within it, so we can then discover the divine in our lives and world. You could say that each week I have to create a kind of theater for my community, so I very much treasure getting to hear your conversations about stories being told in the theaters of our larger culture each week. Thank you. Yeah, I'm Methodist, and I get to see that every week. You know, how is the story going to play out when
That's
you're
cool.
dealing with essentially the same source material?
Yeah.
But anyway, he says, okay, on to my next question/discussion topic. If you were given the task of teaching a class on the history of the last century, but could only use movies as teaching material, what movies would you make your list? Ooh. Let's say there can be 3 to 5 movies per decade.
Oh, jeez. Oh, okay, that's a huge question.
That's a huge question.
We're going to spitball, but we're not going to come to any meaningful... Luca, would you mind not climbing the screen?
But he continues. For a little context, my 10-year-old son was learning about World War I in his school term and inspired me to start looking for movies from that era we would watch together to help him gain some deeper understanding what life in the world was like at the time and also, hopefully, to expand his movie horizons beyond his typical choices.
Right.
I'm guessing All Quiet on the Western Front isn't a modern 10-year-old's first choice.
No, I would recommend for World War I, Joyeux Noël.
Joyeux Noël.
Wonderful film about the Christmas armistice between the French and German soldiers on Christmas and how that has a weird aftermath to it. Like, it was really surprising.
For a 10-year-old, I know you're not a big fan of it, but Spielberg's War Horse. It's a little intense. Bit of a fairy tale about a horse. It's intense, but it's Spielberg, so it has sort of a light feeling. It's also World War
I, let's not pretend it wasn't. Luca, seriously, buddy, we're trying to have a conversation.
I'll continue. I've enjoyed and struggled with this question because it forces me to consider, do I choose movies that depict the biggest events of the time, or select movies that are small stories that may be more deeply representative of every day of human life at the time? Do I pick movies produced during that decade, or movies that were made looking back? Do I stick to movies based on historical events or genre movies that may be more revealing of what was in the hearts and minds of the people that made them? It's so big, but possibly a fun exercise. If you would enjoy it, I would love to hear your pick. Also, as much as my work, my family, and ADHD allow, I will be working on my own list and be ready for summer movie watching with my kid. I wish you both Miles O'Keefe in the new year. But for now, I'm the win, baby. Kevin Lester.
How much Keefe is in this movie anyway?
Miles O'Keefe.
That's an MST3K reference. Well done. First off, thank you for your email. And thank you for the very kind words equating what we do to what you do as a preacher. Now, I may not be a person of a particular faith, but I have a lot of respect for spiritual guidance and spiritual leaders. And using stories that have been told in the past to teach valuable lessons about how to live today and make things that are old seem fresh and new to people who might not otherwise feel a deep connection to it is very important to me. Yeah. So I appreciate that on that level. I think that's wonderful. And it does relate to, of course, the second thing, which is when we use cinema to teach history. First off, and this is just a general rule of thumb, cinema is typically a very bad history teacher. For a variety of reasons,
It is and it isn't. When you're looking for an accurate depiction of events,
yes,
it's not great.
That's my point.
But when you're looking for general attitudes,
yes,
of the way we view certain events, then it's pretty par excellence.
And that's what I was getting at here. So if you're just trying to get like idea of I want to learn about these events, you're not necessarily going to get the best history lesson. But the best thing I think cinema can do is to put you in the shoes of people living in that situation, in which case there are sometimes movies that are made perfectly within the exact time frame that are actually very close to what was actually being felt at the time. But sometimes it takes a little time and a little perspective to understand that point in history well enough to tell that story properly. So you're going to run into movies... they're going to run into both examples, I think.
Let me run a parallel, if I may, to the Gospels. The Gospels were written, historically speaking, from like AD 66 up to like maybe 110-66.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of perspective on recent history.
Yeah.
You don't go to the Gospels for a literal interpretation of facts. There's actually a lot of different perspectives from different authors.
Yeah.
The different writers of the Gospels looked at the same events from different perspectives.
Yeah, there's actually inconsistencies.
If you know a lot about sort of various sects within the Jewish faith at the time, you'll see that there's a lot of different versions of Christianity kind of emerging from just the first four Gospels.
Yeah.
Just from the Gospels. First four books of the New Testament.
Right.
That's cinema, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a perspective on something that happened already. And I feel like that's a little bit more valuable a teacher than trying to get something that is trying to go for something straightforward. Because it's really difficult to make a feature film with historical accuracy because films don't resemble life.
Right.
Sometimes a filmmaker will go way out of their way to get a lot of details correct. Master and Commander is a detail.
Great example. Yeah.
They tried to... Peter Weir, the director, went to the novels by Patrick O'Brien, and both of them were ship obsessives. Mm-hmm. They needed to get every single little detail correct. The Tom Hanks written film, I forgot who directed it, but Greyhound.
Oh, yeah.
About a World War II ship convoy.
Yeah.
Is
solid film.
It's a very good film, but it's all about the technicals. It's about the way the decks looked on the ship and the chain of command and the uniforms.
There's hardly no character development whatsoever. It's just about people doing their jobs.
The characters are hardly matter in that movie, but it's exciting if you're into that technical stuff. And if there are certain films that really delve into those technical details. Mm-hmm. Those are fine places to go for certain details about history.
Yeah.
If you're looking for the history of World War II, Shoah. would be a good place. Yeah. A documentary film.
Great idea.
That's not one I would want to show to a 10-year-old.
No, that's really heavy. And that's the other, but it's also
a 5-hour film, yeah. So it's going to be a little bit of a slog regardless.
And I think World War II is a great example to use as a starting point here, because World War II, arguably the most significant like time period in the 20th century. Everything kind of led up to it, or was a part of the fallout. However, let's say you want to pick like 2 or 3 films to do the history of World War II. I don't think that's possible, because there's multiple different, very important narratives going on.
First of all, what country do you want to?
do you want to talk about? Who's experienced within that country? Because, for example, even if you just want to talk about America, okay, cool. What do you want to talk about in the experience of America? Because what politicians were doing is not necessarily the same as what people like living on the mainland were doing, which is not necessarily the same as what people in the internment camps on the mainland were doing, which is not necessarily the same as what people were doing in the actual war in Europe, which is not the same as what people were doing in the war in the Pacific. So that's a minimum of like a half dozen films to even get a baseline reading of the general text of World War II.
So let's just hover around World War II for a second.
All right.
Good films that depict attitudes about the war.
Mrs. Miniver.
Mrs. Miniver is great.
Yeah, it's a propaganda film, but it's a very thoughtful one.
Propaganda film.
For
the Allies. There's propaganda from the Axis, too, but those are actually incredibly boring movies.
Generally speaking, there's a couple good ones, but not great.
Triumph of the Will comes up a lot. And,
Not for 10-year-old, that's for goddamn sure.
Oh, goodness, no. But if you want sort of a little bit more recent films that have perspective on World War II, Terrence Malick's A Hidden Life is incredibly brilliant. Which is about a German soldier who chooses not to fight
and how, because of
his faith, and is he understands that war is a very wicked thing and is not doesn't coincide with Christian philosophy, and so he decides not to fight, to the chagrin of his entire community, and he's shunned because he won't give in to war. It's about pacifism as a philosophy. I love that movie.
You like it more than I do, but it's a great movie.
If you want to go back to something that's a little closer to the war, and from an American perspective, because Mrs. Miniver is a British film, go to The Best Years of Our Lives. It won Best Picture.
It's like a post-World War II movie, but that's also a very valid experience.
It's about the soldiers' experience after having gone through the trauma of fighting in a war. So it doesn't really have a rosy view of what the war did. It has various perspectives on the war as we were trying to make sense of it after the fact. But that's World War II. There's a lot of films made about World War II. Choose which events you want to focus on and then sort of look around. Like choose what events are from the... And try to, and this is vital, get films from all around the world.
Yeah.
Films from various perspectives. We talked about World War II, but we talked about Terrence Malick, an American filmmaker. William Wyler is an American filmmaker, and Mrs. Miniver is a British film.
Oh, yeah, who directed Mrs. Miniver? Gonna drive me nuts. Hang on, I'll look it up.
An English filmmaker, regardless. Yeah. But we didn't talk about Japanese films made during World War II.
It was William Wyler.
It was also William Wyler.
Okay, there you go. And William Wyler is Swiss, German, and American, so a lot going on there,
There's plenty to go about with World War II. But make sure to sort of go around the world.
Make sure you're telling stories from different perspectives within that. I mean, there are many different movies about the civil rights movement, but make sure you're including films from filmmakers of color.
I think
Selma is an absolutely vital movie about the civil rights movement. It really does have an immediacy and an intensity, a you are there a sense that some of even like the classier other biopics, classier is not the right word, but some of the more gigantic biopics
but there's also a danger when dealing with World War II or any historical event to show the rosiest version of it.
Yeah.
This is something American filmmakers love to do.
Yeah.
Sort of sanitize things, clean them up.
Good thing we were in World War II. Great.
Civil rights is completely taken care of because this Italian white man who eats a lot made friends with a black man once.
That's Green Book. Yeah, Green Book is terrible history. Don't get history.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
the notion of a green book is interesting.
Yes.
Look up what a green book is.
That's fascinating. And but the actual story being told there is deductive.
The history you can learn about a green book, you know, introduce you to that concept. Mm-hmm. That's good.
One of the
story is complete hogwash.
One of the best things to do, and this is, Green Book's a bad example of it, but is to take a story that is not necessarily trying to tell the entire history of a thing, because that can actually be really dull and dry, and try to maybe find something that finds a microcosm, like one thing that happened in that time period. I mentioned Joy is Noel, which is about the Christmas armistice in World War I. That's a good example of that. Or, I'm trying to think now. Like, what's another good example of, like, a movie that's about a small thing that happened inside a bigger thing. Good Night and Good Luck is a really good example of something that, here's what's happening during McCarthyism, this idea that there was this Red Scare and people were afraid of being labeled a communist and they were being blackballed out of their industry. And it's not about that entire thing. It's just about how Edward R. Murrow tried to cover that fairly in an environment that was afraid to make waves at risk of having fingers pointed at them. It's not the greatest movie ever made, but it's a pretty good history film.
And we were just talking about Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Sometimes a light, silly comedy is a great way to learn about
history.
Very
revealing. You can get a lot of British history from that.
I was utterly shocked when a movie came out in the mid-90s called simply Dick. And it stars Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams as these two none-too-bright hippie girls who become really enamored of Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And
they just believe in America.
And so they go to visit Richard Nixon, and this is, like, complete revisionist history. These characters didn't exist, but they kind of, like, sneak in and end up, like, working for Nixon.
Yeah, like his interns.
In his cabinet, and it turns out they're responsible for, like, leaking Deep Throat and... Yeah. The missing minutes on the tape turned out to be like a love song from one of them to Nixon, which he deleted. completely silly, but now you know about that missing time on that Nixon tape, don't you?
Yeah.
All of these little details that are... because it's bizarre, came out in the mid-90s. Did teenagers in the 90s know about details from 25 years earlier in the Nixon administration?
Yeah, it's hard to... I think that's
maybe,
one of the reasons
maybe
that's
not.
That's a cult movie, because who's that for?
Who's that for?
Who was that movie made for, exactly? I don't know. I'm glad
teenagers
it exists.
Teenagers who know a lot about Richard Nixon.
Teenagers know a lot about history. I'm glad it exists, but a weird sell.
But if I'm going to teach somebody about the Nixon administration, first of all, I show them The Post. The Steven Spielberg film.
Great
example. Secondly, I'd show them Dick before I would show them Oliver Stone's film Nixon.
I would show them Frost Nixon. I think that's a really good
film. Yeah, Frost Nixon is another good one.
I think it's an underappreciated film, generally.
It's really quite good.
I know.
one of those films that whose quality was swept up in an Oscar conversation.
And again, it's worth noting that, and this is just because of who we are, where we were raised, where we live, almost every example that we've given is almost exclusively American.
Yeah,
or at least something Americans were connected to.
We're talking about American history, the history of our own country.
Yeah, you have to make a concerted effort sometimes, because if you just go by your stream of consciousness is going to be related to what you already know well.
So
you have to make a concerted effort to go outside of your small box.
Find movies about... Here's a good example. Then these are not ones I would show to a 10-year-old, but I recently discovered the films of Lav Diaz. I started watching them for the first time.
Right.
Most of those movies relate very heavily to the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship in the Philippines. That's not history that's taught very widely in American schools, because it's Filipino history.
Yeah.
It might get a brief chapter in a history book.
Yeah, but they don't typically spend like weeks and weeks on it.
They're not going to delve into sort of how this damaged the country spiritually, and that's what Lav Diaz is interested in.
Yeah.
Watch a Lav Diaz film if you have the time. They're 8-hour movies.
Yeah,
but if you can set the time aside, he delves into that sort of thing. That's a historical event from someone who was there. Watch The Cordillera of Dreams by a Chilean filmmaker named Patricio Guzman. He makes these really dreamy, beautiful documentary films about the dictatorship in Chile.
Yeah.
These are all very fascinating films about a particular place's history. And if you can go to filmmakers from that place that are commenting on where they came from, you're going to get a lot of great perspectives on history.
Yeah. So hopefully that gives you something to start with. Again, that's a big syllabus you're asking. That's gigantic.
We could
work on that for months and not come to something totally satisfying. It's a great idea, don't get me wrong, but it's gigantic. But hopefully we'll give you something to work with. I've thought about this a lot. I don't have children. I don't know if I'll ever have children, but I do think to myself, when do you talk about certain things in history? When do you introduce certain ideological concepts or philosophical concepts or hard truths about the way the world works? You know, that kind of thing. And how the best way to do that educationally or artistically? You know,
how long is Santa visiting your house?
Exactly, that kind of thing. So that's Santa's almost kind of beautiful as like a metaphor, really, for just in terms of like we teach you to believe in things.
Well, innocence in the garden, isn't it?
Well, but there was we just did a commentary track on our thing for the Hogfather, and there was a point in the Hogfather, which is that Santa Claus teaches you that lies are important.
Yeah,
that lies keep like because humanity itself is kind of a lie.
There's a twinge of cynicism in there because the speech is it prepares you for the big lies like justice and righteousness and that there's
things that are we like to believe in because they're important to believe in, but they don't actually like physically exist. They only exist because we believe in them and we value them and we try to manifest them on purpose.
It does imply that all of those things are lies, but
which is a harsh way to put it. But
it's a harsh way to put it. But I think the author Terry Pratchett was a little bit ambivalent about those things. Yeah. So okay. Maybe there's no real justice in the world. Like, physically, you can't measure it anywhere. Mm-hmm. But it's incredibly important.
Yeah, it's important that we make it happen.
And it's important that we keep on making it happen.
It's important to have it as an ideal. And one can make that argument about a lot of things. But anyway, we're off the beaten path. That is We've Got Mail for this week. Thank you, everybody. What amazing questions this week.
Yeah, I got
some good ones. Really cool one. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. We apologize if we didn't get to your email. We'll, of course, be back next week. Feel free to poke us if anything is super time sensitive. That's it for We've Got Mail. If you want to write in, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, once again, what is our P.O. Box?
You can write us in a physical letter, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And, of course, we're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We have a Patreon. That's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And in addition to getting a lot of exclusive shows, like Only the Best, where we review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, or All Our Yesterdays, we review every single Star Trek episode in order, we also have monthly hangouts with some of our patrons. So that's another way to contact us as well. We need to schedule one of those actually really, really soon. Yeah. So you haven't missed February yet. That's still coming up. And I think that's it. No kidding. Wow. Okay, cool. Well, anyway, thank you everybody once again for listening. We think you're absolutely amazing. You got a thing?
Let me plug my other podcast.
Oh, by all means, yes, it's important. Yeah.
All About Ovid. I was talking about Patricio Guzman and Love Diaz. The reason I've been watching some of these movies is because they're on Ovid, the streaming service, Ovid, OVID, and Ovid has a lot of deep cut art house films. And thanks to the resplendently intelligent B. Peterson, she and I have a podcast together about Ovid. It's called All About Ovid, but spelled with O's. Isn't that cute?
O-L-L-O-B-O-U-T. O-V-I-D.
All About Ovid. You cannot... You have to spell it correctly to find it online. On our last two episodes, B and I talked to filmmaker Lynn Sachs, who is a experimental documentarian who has a lot of films on Ovid. So, tune into those conversations we have with Lynn Sachs, because it was a very long, very interesting conversation with an incredibly interesting artist. Yeah. I hope we asked some interesting questions.
Lynn Sachs like retweeted that and was very, very complimentary. It seemed like they had a really wonderful time. Yeah. So that's really exciting. I'm so jealous of you. That sounds like such a good podcast. Anyway, so please check that out if you haven't already. Really incredible stuff over there. And I guess that's it for now. So we'll see you next week. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.